Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we've got an interview guest, Annie Cushion from Cardlytics. She's the CMO there. She'll be discussing their recent holiday data report. We've also, it's earnings season. Don't have that many earnings on today's show. We've got a report from UBS regarding shopping malls that we'll talk about. We'll also talk about Sally Beauty Supply earnings. That's the first time we'll have discussed Sally on the show. And we'll lead off today with Kroger, who led a lot of retail news this week. A reminder to check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. You can also like us, rate us, wherever you do access us in the podcast realm, whether that be Spotify or Apple Podcasts or any other podcast delivery service. So as we mentioned, we'll lead today with Kroger. And Kroger released guidance for 2020 early this week because it was basically their yearly investor presentation. Projections that beat expectations for this coming year, but they kind of curtailed future restock expectations as far as this next quarter is concerned. And we'll talk about some of the expectations for Kroger and then some of the initiatives as well. And normally at the beginning of the story, we introduce the retailer somewhat, but Kroger, like Walmart and Target, they really need no introduction.
It is worth noting that market perceptions of Kroger have been somewhat negative to neutral as of late, as anytime Amazon makes a move in grocery, we see Kroger's market cap shrink. And however, it is clear that Kroger is well positioned to take advantage of online ordering platforms and easily ranks in the top three for digital grocery orders. Building out these platforms along with strong pricing competition over the last 4 years or so has indeed eroded profits somewhat, but we do see, and we'll see it again this quarter, that that is still the case. There was actually an article that said Amazon is beating Kroger and Walmart on prices. It's pretty much laughable, Trent. They've continued, Walmart and Kroger, to have a strong foothold in the pricing wars, at least in the myriad of locations that we visited. This investor presentation came amidst talk of a brand refresh, and we'll get into that in a little bit when I hand this off to Trent. But as for the investor conference, as far as earnings are concerned, Kroger did manage to exceed analyst expectations set for them. Expectations for the last quarter were 41 cents per share, but they came in at 44 cents per share, and that was in the second quarter. But perhaps their main story from this investor presentation came from expectations for the next fiscal year, 2020, where diluted earnings per share was expected to come in at $2.19 per share. Kroger set expectations during the call between $2.30 to $2.40 per share. They also reiterated guidance for 2019 as a whole, including the ongoing quarter, expecting earnings per share to come in between $2.15 and $2.25 per share. This actually would have been higher. It would have been projected to be larger, but CFO Gary Millerchip said during the call that lower pharmacy gross margins and wage investments are serving to hinder drastic short-term profit growth. We've talked about this a lot, Trent. We've talked about their wage investments in the past, but the pharmacy gross margin shrinkage is actually something we literally discussed last week with a Walgreens earnings call. It's hurting the retail pharmacy sector as a whole on the margin front. There's a lot of other good news besides this. And when you see the shares initially after this earnings presentation was released to the public, shares took off around 11% before leveling off later in this week. The other major positive to come out of the presentation was same store sales, something we love to talk about. This figure of comp sales excluding fuel, these were up 2.2% for the current quarter, which outpaces inflation, of course, meaning even with the efforts to reduce pricing, again, trying to really compete on pricing with all of the players in the grocery space, not just Amazon and Walmart, they're driving sales still in a positive direction. It's good to see that number above 2%. Revenue is also beating estimates, by the by. They reaffirmed their expectations for 2019 and in same-store sales as well, projecting them to be between 2 and 2.25% for the year as a whole. Again, a very good sign for the retailer that they're at least beating inflation, but they're still drawing in their customers to those physical locations.
And the main reason we were looking forward to all of this week was because it happens with their investor conference, a number of strategic initiatives get discussed. And Of course, I think most people are somewhat familiar. If you're listening to the podcast, you're probably familiar with the Restock Kroger program, the idea behind transforming Kroger, making them a little bit more capable of handling a digital customer, that type of thing. Well, those were addressed, but there were a few other things that we found more interesting on the call than just a simple update on the Restock Kroger program. First and foremost, they revealed a new logo amidst a much larger brand transformation campaign. Now, the new logo actually looks a lot similar to the old logo. It keeps the dramatic curvature of the K and the G that people are used to. And in fact, I have to admit, when I first saw the new logo, I knew there were some changes. It looked a little bit different, but I had to go back to the old logo to see exactly what it was that they changed. And it still looks like a very early 1900s logo. Interesting step for them, because in many of their Texas locations, some of the ones that I've seen have actually gone away from featuring their logo at all on the outside of stores altogether. They've instead relied on an impact style font for outside signage. You see this in the Houston metro area, in the Dallas metro area as well, where it's just simply a sans serif font, all caps, that says Kroger rather than the actual Kroger logo. However, the font did get a bit of a change here. It appears as though the lettering will be flatter and wider and have a bit more even spacing than the old version. When you look back at the old version, there are some irregularities there, likely because it was designed prior to having the access to graphic design programs there. It seems like it's been pretty similar for a fairly long time. And the other thing that's been added to the logo is their new tagline, Fresh for Everyone, just above the word mark. And that gets used quite a bit in some of their in-store signage they were floating during this presentation. Now, I at least was excited to see that Armin Witt, who's actually a previous podcast guest of ours, he reviewed the new logo on his blog, Brand New, under the headline Kroger, the OG of weird logos. And I've got to say, he's pretty on point there. He says, at first glance, it is both not terrible and terrible, in reference to the fact that they kept the curves in the logo out of the legacy of the brand, kind of the unnatural curves of the K and the G. He also points out that the O and the G in the new logo, with the curve of the G below being a little bit more pronounced, they kind of create a smile in the same style that you see out of the IHOP logo. In summary, he called it a, and I quote this, big, fat, cashable fine with little to no repercussions. And I think this is more of a reference to the ad agency that was in charge of this redesign. But even odder than the logo, at least from my perspective, because the logo is pretty similar to what they had, is a series of kind of 3D claymation looking characters designed to show up on in-store signage. These characters show up alongside that tagline, Fresh for Everyone, and a lot of plays on the term fresh there, with a very plain and almost mid-90s sans serif font, but they're calling these new characters Krogies, like a combination between Kroger and emoji. I wonder how many late nights they spent coming up with that, the ad agency did. In my opinion, at least, these are not great. They look very much like a 90s attempt at customer engagement, and I know sometimes what's old is new again, but most people honestly probably won't notice them. These Krogies have the makings of something that's going to be around for a year or two and then probably will just vanish into the sunset without anyone noticing that they vanished. It's not like the smiley face that you had for Walmart that came back and everyone celebrated when Smiley came back. I think this is a little bit different, and I don't think these have as much staying power. And if you're looking at something like a Kroji and trying to get that staying power out of it, but they look like something no one's going to miss, that's not a good thing for brand identity. Now, in their press release, they did note that they are going all in with ad buys for this new image. In fact, I heard Spotify ads for this ad campaign this week. However, one thing to note is the campaign won't necessarily extend to all of their brands. So King Soopers in Colorado, where I live, for example, hasn't adopted the tagline in their advertising, either radio advertising or television advertising or online advertising just yet. And it's going to take some time because, remember, Kroger has so many sub-brands. Layton mentioned last week Ralph's in California, but you've got Dillon's in the Midwest, Gerb's, Smith's, all of these different brands there for Kroger. It's going to take some time to pull this out as far as their new image, their new tagline, fresh for everyone. And of course, the Kroger logo really only affects the part of the country that those Kroger stores are actually in, mostly the South and in Texas, ranging on north into Ohio and Detroit. So a couple of things to note there as well.
Perhaps of more note is that Kroger is, in following Amazon's lead, offering deals on its ClickList program in time for the holidays. They are offering free grocery pickup through January 1st, 2020, where there's generally a $4.95 fee associated with the service. However, for all the attention paid to its brand identity rollout, there wasn't much of substance in relation to Kroger's restock program that we've heard so much about. Much of it was the same as it has been: continued digital investment, continued efforts to upgrade the front store experience, and of course, the throughput. And one more notable thing we wanted to discuss that came from the investors' presentation is their plans to roll out more plant-based products through their private label, Simple Truth. That private label brand has really grown over the past few years, and it's taken more and more of a percentage of total revenue. You see this with a lot of other retailers, namely Target, who's been rebranding their own private label products as of late. The rollouts are slated for the calendar year 2020 and will include 58 total offerings in all. That's a lot. And this is a phenomenon that I've discussed around 6 months ago on the show, as plant-based meat and dairy substitutes are climbing in market share, albeit a little bit slowly. And it was actually said this summer that the U.S. plant-based retail is worth around $4.5 billion, with that expected to increase just over 10% by 2020. Still, it's taking over a little bit more of the market share year by year. And even though this is relatively, or in fact, a very small piece of the U.S. food puzzle, Kroger clearly thinks that this is a category worth exploring more. Among the plant-based products they are seeking to roll out is a plant-based queso dip, along with some meat substitutes. And this is interesting, Trent. This is interesting for a number of reasons, but it's an interesting development, as it is with pretty much anything in the private label space, as Kroger has strong and established relationships with existing brands in the plant-based space already, most notably Beyond Meat. In fact, the relationship with Beyond is so strong that they have deals in place to carry products in certain portions of the store. And this is akin to what we saw many, many years ago, where Sony was trying to broker deals with Target and Walmart to make sure that they had the most traffic space in their stores to show off their new electronics. But the same thing here: Beyond is a fast-moving company, and they see Kroger as a very valuable partner, and it really suits Kroger as well to have it be something where they're trying to really capture a new market entirely and capture the attention of their customers coming into the store, noticing these Beyond products for the first time. And time will tell, but we both agree that they aren't likely to see a stemming of the tide with movements like this towards plant-based food anytime soon. Finally, Trent, from the call, they noted a number of implementations that we've actually discussed in previous Looking Ahead segments, making it look as though we may, from time to time, know what we're talking about. But first was the appeal product, which they are using to prolong the shelf life of avocados for the time being. As a refresher, this product basically offers a plant-based outer coating to fruits and vegetables to stave off over-ripening and spoilage. They are also trialing growing produce in store. This was the one thing that caught my attention, particularly greens and herbs. While there is a massive potential for failure here, absolutely there is, this would dramatically decrease spoilage and increase shelf life if they could successfully pull this off. But it's still going to be a few years before we see chain-wide implementation of this type of program.
Well, coming up after this break, once again, we'll be joined by Danny Cushion, the CMO of Cardlytics, and we'll talk about their most recent holiday data release. Well, as we mentioned on last week's show, we're bringing back the interview segment for this week's show, and we're pleased to have someone that was kind of a regular guest on the podcast, the CMO of Cardlytics, Danny Cushion, on the show. This time she joins us to talk about their annual holiday spend data that they just released, over the last couple of weeks. We've gotten some good numbers from this, and she's joining us to talk about it here today. Dani, thank you much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. Really happy to be back.
So the first question, we always kind of start out with this just to give some perspective for our listeners here. As far as the data that Cardlytics gets, there's a massive data pool that you're really pulling this from. Where does this data come from, and what is Cardlytics' core competency, so to speak?
That's a great question. I think Cardlytics is what we would call a native app platform built within banks. And what we mean by that is we actually run the cashback loyalty programs for banks like Chase, Bank of America, PNC, Regions, Lloyds, really the largest banks in the U.S. and the U.K. And as a result of bringing advertisers to bank customers to give them cashback on the things they like to buy, we are able to aggregate all of the spend data from these banks in a privacy-safe way. We do not see personally identifiable information. But what we do get to see is how consumers are shopping. And we see about $2.8 trillion in purchase data across debit cards, credit cards, ACH, and bill pay. And so what we like to do is we love to sort of geek out on our data and use the data to be able to pull analytics and look at how are consumers shopping. What are the spend trends that we see? We work very, very closely with marketers to help them figure out what is happening in consumer shopping behavior. And then we use that to inform the advertising that they run on our platform within the banks.
So as we mentioned, just a tremendous pool of data that we're looking at here. And one of the key pieces of data I think we are always looking at is, did holiday spend increase? And we know that it did over 2017, although maybe not as much as some of the more bullish analysts were expecting because of other macro factors there. But in your report, there's something interesting about last year's relationship between basket size and number of transactions, where we actually saw a number of transactions increase and basket size went the other way. What were some of the reasons behind this?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And what I would just caveat is in our data, we see the what. We don't necessarily see the why. But since we work with, you know, most of the country's major retailers, we have a pretty fair idea of what's happening as to why. So as you mentioned, you know, holiday spend increased. But what's interesting is consumers are making more frequent but smaller purchases. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's just super convenient to impulse buy online. It's really easy to be able to just go in and make a simple purchase. We do think the friction in, you know, shipping costs has reduced drastically where everyone wants to be competitive. It's a lot easier for consumers just to buy small items and not have to amass a large basket before they actually check out.
When we're talking about free shipping costs and free shipping thresholds, that type of thing, is this kind of an inherent advantage to those retailers that have those free shipping thresholds lower because we are seeing a lower basket size, people going online for just the one or two items at a time?
Absolutely. And again, while our data doesn't necessarily hold against what are all the costs, you know, benefit analyses of these retailers doing it, I think the ones that are getting it very right, either the online-only players like Amazon, Zappos, also part of Amazon, of course, others, and the brickandmortar.com players. So it's sort of a term that we made up, but a brick and mortar store who has built out their own e-commerce site. You see a lot of this happening in the market. You see a lot of competition for faster, cheaper shipping deals. And it really, really matters. It really matters as to when consumers are shopping and how consumers are shopping. With the data that we do see, you know, the purchase data, we can see purchases made both online and in store. And so it's pretty interesting, actually, to see when consumers and how consumers are shopping across the holiday period and when online sales are spiking versus when in-store sales are spiking. And shipping reliability, we think, plays a lot into this. And it's really about what's convenient for consumers and how do they want to buy, where it's going to be very easy and low friction for them.
You mentioned that term brickandmortar.com, which is a term I absolutely love because I feel like it sums up kind of that middle between the online pure plays and the sales that actually take place in the brick and mortar stores. But one of the things that the study mentions is that omnichannel shoppers, so those that are shopping both online and in the physical retail stores, seem to make up a disproportionately large amount of spend for these retailers. So just how much more valuable to retailers are these omnichannel shoppers? And do you feel like there's some white space for retailers to kind of capitalize on there?
That's a great question. I think it's interesting to see what we would call an omnichannel shopper is somebody that buys both online and in store within a given brand. Typically, when we are looking at it, particularly in the holiday season, customers who shop both online and in store at a given retailer end up spending twice as much during the holidays versus those who shop in one channel or the other. So that's very, very significant. That's a really, really big difference. But what's interesting, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with the white space. What we're seeing is only about 10% of the retail customer base that we look at. So, you know, all the customers that we're looking at their spend behavior, only 10% are exhibiting this behavior so far. So if you think about companies like Home Depot or Target or others who are doing a really good job of driving this cross-channel shopping behavior, it pays off for them. You know, Walmart does this in a really good way. There are a lot of brands who are actually really understanding that if you can build a customer's shopping behavior to go back and forth and shop with you in any way that they want to, in a consistent way, just whenever they feel like it, if you have a very, very strong in-store and online presence, it absolutely pays off to the bottom line.
I wanted to ask kind of a follow-up on this, and I know your data is a little bit agnostic as to the why, but I think there's kind of a dialogue amongst retailers about which comes first. It's kind of like a chicken or the egg argument there. Does the brand loyalty come first to shop both online and in-store for those customers? Or are the omni-channel options leading to brand loyalty? And in your conversations with retailers, which way are they leaning?
You know, it's a really interesting question because a lot of the work that we do with brands has to do with looking at driving the next sale, and trying to look at building relationship with customers as part of a broader loyalty continuum, as opposed to just marketing to customers within a distinct time period. And I'll answer your question, and I'll throw something on top of that because I think it's pretty interesting. The folks that we're looking at are trying to figure out both at the same time. It's not just a matter of the channel and the how, but it's also when you're actually addressing customers to drive that loyalty. I think where we're actually seeing the ones that are most successful are the brands who recognize that a lot of spend, particularly in the holidays, happens from repeat customers. And so I'll throw another number at you, which is actually pretty staggering. But about 70% of holiday sales come from repeat customers, and they spend 43% more than new customers. And so I think what's interesting there is the brands that we work with really understand that it's about making sure that you build a relationship with customers over time and always look at driving the next sale and being consistent and accessible in however they want to buy. So it's not an either or. They're really looking at both. And the ones that have done this very well understand that you have to be out ahead of the actual time period that you want people to shop. But we actually put out some other research on our back-to-school spend trends that show that a customer that's acquired in the fall for the first time ends up spending 20% more in the holiday period than those that are acquired for the first time within the holiday. So again, the brands that are getting it are thinking about how do I get ahead of key shopping periods by acquiring customers early enough and building that relationship so that they sort of get a double whammy effect. They're not just getting sales in the fall, they're also significantly increasing their opportunity for the holiday season where it's really competitive.
And I'm going to bring in some of your other data here to kind of back up that point, because one of the other things that your data kind of shows is this concept of a flattening of the holiday season. So it makes sense that those customers that convert during back-to-school shopping are larger holiday spenders, because we're no longer, it seems like, seeing the spikes that we once did. As far as that particular data, what data are you seeing that says that basically holiday sales moving earlier and earlier in the year, and we're no longer seeing those big spikes around Black Friday and right before Christmas?
Yeah, it's been interesting actually for us. I mean, this is the fifth year of our annual spend trend report, and it's interesting to see how it's changed, how shopping behavior has changed over the last few years. I think what I would say is Black Friday and Cyber Monday are still very, very important for retailers, but it used to be that it was a pretty big peak in the middle. If you think about the holiday shopping period as a time frame and draw a line as to when shopping is actually happening, it used to be a pretty significant peak right in the middle, centered around Black Friday and Cyber Monday as the kickoff. What we've seen in the last year or two is that holiday shopping has been pulling earlier and earlier and earlier every year, to the point where in 2018, almost 40% of the holiday spend that occurred actually happened in the 4 weeks before Black Friday. And that was actually up from 30% the prior year. So I think what we're seeing is Amazon Prime Day and Amazon Prime Week has been a significant driver of this. It doesn't necessarily mean that people are shopping for the holidays on Prime Day, but it has created more of an always-on kind of shopping behavior. And, I mean, 40% of holiday spend before Black Friday, that's a lot. And so we've generally seen, rather than a big peak in the middle, we've generally seen a flattening out of that line. It doesn't mean it's down. It just means it's flatter and more consistent across the period, where customers are actually shopping both earlier and paradoxically later. So, and I'll explain. They're shopping earlier, but there's also a pretty interesting last-minute kick for brick-and-mortar purchases too. You know, once, even though online shopping and the, you know, reduced friction shipping has made it easier for shoppers, self-included, you know, to be able to buy gifts really late online, there's still a little bit of that trust factor that we see an interesting sort of right before holiday spike for in-store shopping, where folks are flying into a store in the last week or so before the holiday just to pick up all those last-minute items. It's really fun to be able to share that kind of information with marketers, that they can figure out how do you actually market and what do you actually say that resonates with consumers based on how they like to shop. Because at the end of the day, the brands that are getting it right are the ones that are really catering to making it easy for consumers to do their holiday shopping, and understanding how they shop is really the first step of that.
So we talk about, you know, the spike later on in the holiday season, that last-minute shoppers. We always see a lot of marketing surrounding that. But with the marketers that you work with, what are some of the new forms of marketing that we're seeing surrounding those 4 weeks prior to Thanksgiving?
Yeah, I don't know about new forms of marketing as much as when they're actually going to market. And I think if you, even for this holiday period in particular, you see a lot of loyalty promotional type messages coming out now. And Walmart's a great example, actually. I've been getting a bunch of their emails and, you know, just seeing them start the conversation for Holiday Now. Gap just recently rolled out their holiday campaign a week ago. So it's interesting to see. It's less how they're marketing, it's more when. And I think the ones that are ahead of it are the ones that will capture share, because as much as you can laugh at it, I was in a CVS over the weekend and went in for a bunch of stuff and ended up walking out of there with advent calendars. And it might not have been my intention, but clearly it was there for a reason, because I was ready to buy. So as much as we as consumers can laugh at the fact that it feels like the holidays are coming earlier and earlier in every year, we are encouraging that behavior. And the smart retailers take advantage of it by putting out marketing campaigns now and actually really putting them out a couple months ago, with back to school and fall type messaging to flow into the holidays. Because again, it really is about a continuum, not distinct time periods within which you should be marketing to consumers.
And as we wrap up, as far as this study is concerned, we've talked about some of the bigger numbers coming out of the study. Was there anything else in this holiday spend data that you looked at that said, you know, maybe stood out to you, maybe not caught you by surprise, but stood out to you as something that retailers should be paying attention to or taking advantage of?
Yeah, I think the biggest one I think that's interesting to note is, as much as online is growing, and it really is growing continually year over year, brick and mortar still makes up the lion's share of where spend is happening. So I think in this past year, it was about 78%, something like that. Now, year over year, it did go down about 1.5 share points. But I think what's interesting is, and this is sort of why we coined this brickandmortar.com term, because it's important to look at where online share is going. So while brick and mortar itself, it's not new news, it's, you know, it's compressed and under pressure from a brick and mortar standpoint, the online portion is growing both by the online only players like an Amazon, but also the brick and mortar companies who have really cracked the e-com side of things. So the online only merchants, you know, advertisers are growing their share of spend. I think year over year, it was like 1.3% to almost 13% of share. But the brickandmortar.com are up as well to about 8.5%. And so what's really interesting and important about that is the players, the brands who have figured out that e-com is incredibly important, you have to be where your consumers want to buy, are actually starting to hold up the walls a little bit because they're giving an alternative to customers who want to shop online. Those customers are likely shopping at Amazon as well. Amazon's still doing great, but the folks who are primarily brick and mortar, if they've gotten e-com in order, they're actually starting to win share back because it's all about customer convenience and making sure that you have a consistent shopping experience across channels. And again, that ties really nicely back to omni-channel and how much more valuable those customers are. So that's continually, we continue to see that the brands that do well are the ones that really put the customer first and are present in every channel that they want to buy in.
And as we kind of wrap things up, you know, Cardlytics produces these type of reports for multiple occasions. You mentioned, of course, the back-to-school one. We see the holiday spend data report. What's next on the docket for Cardlytics as far as the next data set we can expect to see released?
We always sort of look at the data as it comes through the holiday period as well. So we'll probably do a post-holiday recap. And, you know, quite frankly, we like to do these things right after the holiday because that's when we start working with our marketing partners to help inform how they actually are going to go to market. But we put out regular reports on our website on cardlytics.com. We do deep dives around different verticals like travel and grocery and, you know, e-commerce. So we're always sort of trying to look at key spend trends across different verticals. This is a heavy retail season, but there's a lot of fun stuff coming out. And yeah, just appreciate the time to be able to talk through it today.
Well, I appreciate you joining us once again, CMO of Cardlytics, Danny Cushion. Thanks so much for being with us on the podcast today.
Great. Thank you, Trent.
Once again, we thank Danny for joining us here on the show, and we transition to a new study from UBS that suggests that people are attracted to malls more so due to the food court now, of all things. Now, one thing I do want to let everyone know is there are a lot of deceiving, a lot of misleading, clickbaity headlines, and I want to preface this study with the disclaimer that it wasn't completely correctly represented in a few media outlets this week with suggestions that people go to malls mostly because of the food court or more so than for shopping. That isn't the case quite yet, as Leighton will talk about. However, this data from UBS does suggest that the food offerings in malls are becoming a larger reason as far as why people do choose to go to the shopping centers, whether or not they actually do any shopping.
This study in particular looked at 2,500 consumers throughout the United States. They found that generally food courts are a larger reason for driving traffic than in the past, but the attraction of food courts hasn't been enough to offset the loss of traffic otherwise. When we talk about this all of the time, and we'll note later on in this segment that it really depends on the type of mall and what they have in terms of the food offerings, because if it's a C-class mall, you may only see 3 or 4 food vendors as opposed to an A-class mall. But again, as we discussed last week, and seemingly every week, A-class malls aren't really struggling as much as some of the lower-class malls, so you are apt to see more food vendors, more restaurants serving those customers. As Retail Wire notes, this study's findings don't quite sync up with prior studies, which found that food courts and food halls, the latter of which is somewhat of a new development, support retail offerings in general. UBS's standpoint, after looking at the data, suggests that food offerings drive traffic, but not necessarily adjacent shopping. Those that say they go to the mall to eat, only to eat, rose from 4 to 7% in this year's iteration of the study. Again, 7% is a fairly small number of respondents. Even still, in this case, in this particular case, with 2,500 total respondents, 7% only represents 175 of those. You might ask, at that point, if it was even worth the headlines the story generated this week. It was all over our Twitter feed, Trent, and we actually retweeted a couple stories about this. But meanwhile, the number of shoppers who go to a mall to visit, according to the study, to visit a department store dropped from 25% to 20%. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that a lot of department stores no longer exist as mall anchors. They've either redeveloped the space into different entertainment attractions, or you see the vacancy from a number of Sears stores that is going to skew that number in the short term before that space can be redeveloped. But Retail Wire, more specifically George Anderson, dug a bit deeper regarding the findings from this survey. First, he noted a Cushman and Wakefield study that found the number of food halls, different, again, slightly from food courts, is likely to increase in malls from 70 in 2018 to 300 by 2020. There are certainly reasons for this, among others that the optionality when it comes to food is a benefit for families and groups of people who might not really want to choose just one eatery to consume a meal at. So you have more optionality at the typical food hall. In fact, the concept behind food hall type establishments is growing outside of the mall space, with several popping up in larger metropolitan areas. The benefit of these carries also into alcohol serving and consumption, as they often feature a bar with a common drinking area, allowing for typical socialization. There's actually an area called the District near where I live where a lot of people come there, not for the retail experience, but for the socialization. There is a bar in sort of the center circle area that a lot of people go to when they get off work. Yes, they might peruse the different offerings from pop-up shops that are around there, but mostly they're there for food and drink. However, say all of that, Retail Wire also noted a prior report from Jones Lang LaSalle that found that shoppers who eat at the mall spend around 35 extra minutes browsing stores compared with those who did not eat there. So we're talking about larger malls here. That is a lot of extra time for people to be shopping. And guess what? Within those 35 minutes, they could be buying something potentially. So 35 minutes of extra shopping, not just eating. So they're there to look at other merchandise. And there were some other things, Trent, noted by the study, including 77% of digital natives saying that if farmers market would actually influence their decision to visit a mall. Also, grocery stores were also seen as a draw across all age groups, 61% for younger consumers and 55% for the older ones.
Now, this harkens back to what we discussed last week surrounding ROIC's earnings call, where grocery stores seem to be a major draw for retail centers in general. One of the reasons their occupancy rates have been up over 97% to this point, and honestly shows no signs of slowing, even with more grocery sales moving to digital. I found the farmers market question to be quite interesting because the dynamics surrounding having a farmers market of some sort in a mall can be somewhat difficult depending on your state, depending on your locality, where you're at. There are different regulations surrounding fresh food. There are different regulations as far as who is taking on the liability for that as well. A lot of people associate farmers markets with some of that fresh food offering as well as getting the produce and some of the value-added goods. But that's one of the reasons why when you look at farmers markets on the whole, they're in public property and not privately held property. It's going to be a difficult ask to just say to a REIT, hey, by the way, you need to have a farmers market at this indoor mall, because that is a very, very difficult proposition. Food licenses may be required, especially for sales of produce. So a lot going on there. It seemed like an odd question for a survey of this type. The other thing that I wanted to mention is this particular study from UBS, or at least they quote that currently 25% of all apparel is purchased online. And this is according to their numbers, but this is kind of where we see the limitation of small sample sizes in UBS's former research, as this number significantly outpaces the average that we see from larger data aggregators, including Cardlytics, if you will, about what is being purchased online and what is being purchased in stores. The other thing that I'll mention too, and I'll talk about this in further depth, but UBS just sees digital as digital. They don't break it down into sales that may touch those physical stores, even though they were initiated digitally. So that's an important thing. And also, I do want to mention that UBS as a whole has been very bearish on brick and mortar retail, especially clothing stores, of which they say around 21,000 need to close by 2026. And that's a direct quote, at least, or about one quarter of the current retail clothing landscape. They say overall that retail could stand to lose about 70,000 total new outlets because of that transition to digital. Now, I say all of that to say this. Greg Buzek of the IHL Group has openly in the past called out data that UBS has generated in the past, saying the firm has somewhat misrepresented their data or maybe misinterpreted the data. Part of this is because UBS is not accounting for that brickandmortar.com as referenced by Danny Cushion in our interview today, and instead breaks down their data as binary. It's either e-commerce or physical with them without including the massive amount of buy online and in-store digital fulfillment we see today. And I think it's important when you read articles like this that are citing information from historically bearish outlooks from companies like UBS, that you take into account data from multiple vantage points. And, you know, we had Danny on the show. She was talking about how important those omni-channel customers are. Well, if you close down those retail stores in those markets, you can't have that omni-channel approach. You can't bring in those high-dollar customers. So, again, important to take all of this with a grain of salt. Important to take what UBS is throwing out there with a grain of salt. Most news outlets did not do that. Layton referenced the jump from 4 to 7%. So a lot of people were saying, well, the number of people going to malls just for the food court jumped by 75%, which seems like a big number. But in the scheme of things, far more people are still visiting malls for those department stores. And again, it depends on the type of class of mall that you've got going on there. Now, a lot of REITs know that a good food offering or a good slate of food offerings will bring people in, and they will let people stay in the mall longer because you don't have to worry about people getting hungry, people leaving the premises to go eat. So definitely those food halls, the food courts, a big proposition for retailers there. So just something that we wanted to mention here on the show because it was in a lot of news outlets this week. Now we close briefly with a retailer that actually we've never discussed on the podcast before in Sally Beauty Supply. This will be a shorter story, but they came out with their quarterly earnings call on Thursday prior to market open, Layton, and expected earnings of 53 cents per share going into the call.
We've talked a lot about their competitor in Ulta Beauty, as well as Sephora, which is in a number of JCPenney stores throughout the country and drives a lot of traffic to ailing JCPenney stores. And you look internationally, Sally Beauty has 5,061 stores across Sally Beauty Supply and, of course, their Sally Beauty Systems group overall. It's a lot of stores to be talking about, a lot of stores in North America, but again, an international presence to boot. The call came along with the headline, Sally Beauty Holdings Incorporated delivers on 2019 full-year financial guidance and announces successful fourth quarter, which is certainly a self-aggrandizing take. And this is interesting, Trent, because this is a company that has grown significantly over the last decade, but again, just really for one reason or another hasn't hit our radar. As far as the numbers are concerned, they did see positive same-store sales for their major banners in the most recent quarter, which ended in September. With their beauty systems group, they saw same-store sales increase of just 0.8%. Like to see that number a little bit higher, but meanwhile, with their better-known Sally Beauty group, their same-store sales were up 1.3%. Neither one equivalent to inflation, of course, but also not bad in an era where we are seeing a ton of business transfer to competitors that I just mentioned, like Ulta, or online in general. A lot of startups really trying to take advantage of niche beauty products. In fact, you'll see that even on Shark Tank, Trent. You'll see startups profiling just one or two or three products, but those products sell a ton of volume. They move a lot and they compete directly with the companies such as Sally Beauty Holdings. And speaking of online, their e-commerce sales were pretty much the star of the show, up 27.4% over last year's fourth quarter. And that tells us one thing and one thing only. They have smart management, smart enough to identify that the major risk to their beauty market share is coming from both the large and small entrants in the e-commerce space. And I think that really speaks to how they've been reactive a little bit, maybe not as proactive in the beginning, but they've been reactive enough to be able to now sustain double-digit increases for several quarters in a row. Now, given that this was their fourth quarter, they also released full-year numbers. Same-store sales were up 0.3% for the full year. So you can tell that in terms of the physical stores, they have a lot of room to grow or at least to improve upon what they have currently. Granted, we should also keep in mind that this is against a backdrop of aggressive store closures, targeting less successful outlets. So that consolidation overall is going to affect the same store sales increase that took place with the stores that remained open and did not include the 95 stores closed in the last year. Same store sales for the fourth quarter were negative across all stores last year. So any development here is a positive. GAAP net earnings in the fourth quarter were $69 million, which was an increase of 25% over last year. Fairly strong earnings there. Adjusted diluted earnings per share of 58 cents also beat on analyst expectations.
Of more note, perhaps, as far as looking ahead is concerned, of course, their fiscal year 2020 guidance, which is usually issued by companies in their fourth quarter earnings call. Now, they expect same-store sales in the neighborhood of right around where we saw it actually this past quarter of positive 0.5 to 1.5%. So that's certainly a good thing for, again, a retailer coming from a background where they had a couple of really struggling years, especially in some of their smaller format stores. Additionally, they anticipate opening 30 to 50 net new stores, which is remarkable given their recent climate of store closures that Layton just talked about as far as getting those same store sales up and closing some of those underperforming stores. Now, as Layton mentioned, Ulta Beauty is kind of the standard bearer, or we think of as the standard bearer in this particular segment. Sally Beauty Supply is kind of straddling a couple of different principles of business. One is they do want to bring in, of course, the public customer, but another is they do service and supply a lot of stylists as well, almost on a wholesale platform. So that part of it is important to them as well. Now, as far as developments for the company that they talked about in this past quarter, and one of the reasons why that headline was so bullish on the progress of the company, they reached 16 million active members in their Sally Beauty Rewards program, continued to see increased redemptions of reward certificates. This is big for Sally Beauty Supply because in digging through the past, and as I mentioned, we haven't covered them on the podcast to this point in the nearly 5 years we've been doing the podcast, but when you look at it, that's been a big question for Sally Beauty Supply. How do you get people to actually not just enroll in the rewards program, but use it and drive those people back into stores? So that's a big thing. The fact that they're seeing those increased redemptions of those reward certificates, a big positive for them. Additionally, they signed a multi-year agreement with Alliance Data and their card services business to launch a new private label credit card program for Sally Beauty Supply and Beauty Systems Group both. Layton and I have talked on the show in the past. Anytime you can sign one of these deals as a retailer, usually it means you're just getting straight up dividends from that credit card program. So that can't help but be a positive for them. They're also rolling out some new concept stores coming up. They've got some concept stores planned for a second metro area, already have some that opened in a first metro area, and looking to roll that out to a multi-state region during the next fiscal year. Now, as far as e-commerce, Layton talked about the robust growth in e-commerce there. They did refresh the sites just in this past quarter, but a big thing that they talked about on the call was the color view or color before you commit hair color technology. And this is not something we talk about a lot on the podcast just because everyone's talking about the potential and how it can be used, but there are a lot of pitfalls. It's usually very expensive to actually operate there. But we're seeing furniture retailers do this a lot, especially e-commerce furniture retailers. And now Sally Beauty jumping into this as well as Ulta has been for the last little while. But they actually rolled this technology out in kiosks at about 500 Sally Beauty stores. And what this does is allow customers to kind of see the projected hair color on themselves through that virtual reality setup before they buy. So again, we're talking about virtual reality here, something that we don't discuss a lot on the show for various different reasons, but this is something that Sally Beauty has actually been able to implement in this prior quarter. And what's more is they were able to roll this technology out to their mobile app, and their app, as a result, has taken off in terms of popularity. They've got over 500,000 downloads now on the app, most of that with a younger demographic, which is, of course, very important to try and bring those customers in as they hit that maturity level, as they start to get that discretionary income where they can be spending that money at a Sally Beauty Supply, at least from a marketing perspective. The other thing I'll note here is these type of technology rollouts, while not necessarily new to the industry, because Ulta's been doing this type of thing for a while now, it is new to some of these markets that Sally does business in. Sally Beauty Supply is a lot like some of the other retailers that do business in small to mid-sized markets. You look at Hibbett Sports, you look at Maurice's out there, where they do business in a lot of towns as small as 4,000 to 5,000 people. So you're looking at these technology enhancements where, for some customers, because they're not going to the Ulta Beauty, because they're not going to a different supplier, this is really the first time they've gotten a chance to interact with this. And again, that's a positive recipe as far as customer engagement is concerned. Now, looking ahead for 2020, they're looking to launch a new brand campaign, not unlike Kroger, who we led off the show with. But a big topic of conversation for them was optimizing their supply chain. Again, they're an international network. They've got a lot of different levers to worry about. They're looking to close off distribution nodes, mostly in Europe, and expand distribution capacity in certain areas. They're also just launching a new 500,000 square foot distribution center in North Texas. So that's a big thing for them. Also, and this is an appropriate way to close out things given what we've talked about a lot with omnichannel, but they're attempting to use a new order management system that was just implemented this year at the company to support testing buy online and same day delivery at their beauty systems group and buy online ship from store at Sally Beauty Supply. So again, those online sales, those e-commerce sales, touching those physical stores can't help but be a positive for a company like Sally going forward.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Layton and I talk about a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year, and we begin with Layton.
Last week, I said I was going to keep it short, but then I went on for about way too long. I don't know exactly how long I went on, but I'll keep it a little bit shorter this week. Trent, the story I am looking at, again, crossing our Twitter feed, a story about Walgreens, which is a company that we mentioned on this podcast today, and we mentioned through their earnings coverage last week. The reason it is my looking ahead is since last week, news has broken. According to Reuters on Tuesday, Walgreens is apparently in some preliminary discussions to be taken private. They're reaching out to several large private equity firms about being able to put together a deal, which would be, by the way, the biggest leveraged buyout in history. You look at the current market cap of Walgreens, and you can look up their stock symbol, WBA. The current stock price is $58 a share. With the outstanding shares out there, it equates to a market cap of around $52.3 billion. So if you think about that number for a second, that's essentially what would have to be put together. Around 80% of that figure would have to be brought from private equity firms in order to take this company private. Not only that, current shareholders would, of course, have to approve it. It would have to go through the regulatory procedures. That would be a massive undertaking for pretty much an institution at this point. Walgreens has been a publicly traded company since 1979, Trent. So I'm looking at the graph here. If you were an investor pretty much dating back from the year 2000 and before that, you are very, very wealthy. If you had a lot of shares in Walgreens, you've done very well for yourself. But that is the big question, and that's why it's my looking ahead. What stakeholders are going to look at this deal and approve it, if it even happens? Because according to sources, people have not even agreed on any likely terms of this deal. And as of late, private equity firms, the largest private equity firms out there, have not really been wanting to partner with each other on brokering these types of deals. And so when you compound that with the fact that this would be a massive deal overall, a very complex deal that, by the way, involves a company that already has very high regulatory oversight because they deal in pharmaceuticals, you're looking at one very complex situation. So what is it going to mean for the shareholders? What is it going to mean for the management? The CEO, by the way, owns 16% of the company. That's why I said you would have to have a little bit over 80% to take this company private, because he actually controls quite a bit of the shares. But he could actually roll his equity into the deal as well to help finance the transaction, according to sources. But you're looking at a company that has been in sort of its own crisis over the last 12 months, in large part due to what Trent has mentioned several times, which is the pharmaceutical margin. So you're looking at a lot of generics that are now hitting the market, and you're looking at a lot of wholesale competition in the entire sector. So whenever your margins shrink, and that's around 67, 68% of what they sell are pharmaceuticals, you're going to see earnings per share get affected year after year after year. And while we still see this company as being one that's going to be profitable for the next 15, 20 years, investors don't like to see shrinking margins, consistently shrinking margins. And with that, Trent, I'll end with this. I'll remind our listeners, last week we talked about this, but they're looking to 2020 and they're basically saying that adjusted earnings per share are going to be the same, or maybe even, according to some analysts, slightly less than in 2019. And it was not that long ago, we were covering Walgreens on the podcast about 3 to 4 years ago, when we said, this is a company that really sees the big picture for what it is, an increasing market for pharmaceuticals in the United States. Yet the regulatory environment and the competition from the likes of those in the e-commerce realm and the brick and mortar realm have completely turned the story around. It's taken us by surprise, and it has apparently taken leadership by surprise, because otherwise they would not be looking to large private equity firms to potentially be taking the company private.
Well, Layton talked about a pharmacy chain in his looking ahead story. I'm going to look at a retailer that started out as a pharmacy chain, declared bankruptcy this year, liquidated nearly all their assets, but still exists in a very small form. And I'm talking about Shopko. And Layton, I think you'll find this story interesting here, as Shopko has announced that they are opening up a new optical center at 1701 East Madison Avenue in Mankato, Minnesota. Now, this is something that even we kind of glossed over in the Shopko bankruptcy that took place earlier this year. You know, they had no choice but to liquidate most of their retail holdings. A number of their retail stores have been turned into anything from other retailers to churches. But the Shopko brand, logo, everything lives on in the form of these optical centers. So the reason I'm looking ahead is they are constantly adding more locations. Shopko has said in media outlets that indeed they are looking to add to their number of locations total for their optical. And it's funny, because you go to shopko.com, you just go to the website, and it has kind of a splash page there that says Shopko Optical is here to stay. They are taking up these locations that are fairly small, about 2 to 10,000 square feet. They're selling glasses, basically, in these optical locations. So it's kind of an interesting thing. Shopko still operating in the form of these optical stores. The reason I'm looking ahead is this going to be a situation like Toys R Us or Circuit City, where we actually see these retailers come back in some way, shape, or form, kind of use that bankruptcy, use that liquidation to regrow from scratch? Or is it something that's quite honestly going to be limited to optical? Again, Shopko was held by a private equity firm. Obviously, the private equity firm found some sort of value in terms of those optical centers to have those still operating. And in fact, the optical website still says copyright Shopko stores at the bottom of the page. So is it a circumstance where Shopko and the brand is going to make a comeback, or is it pretty much just going to be in the optical realm until their optical outlets eventually inevitably get bought out by another operator? So that's my looking ahead for this week. That'll do it for this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Once again, big thanks to Danny Cushion for joining us here on the show from Cardlytics. And we'll be back with you 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.